Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm today's host, Brian Lanzone. Coming up on today's program, correspondent Tom Wilmer remembers the Little Rock Nine and also takes a trip to some museums in Independence, Missouri, including a hair museum. Also, Marisa Waddell visits with Cuesta College vocal instructor John Knutson and learns about the music program at the college and a vocal jazz festival coming up in November. But first, Leslie Westbrook has the profile of this Santa Barbara composer, Daniel Lentz.
That's the music of Santa Barbara-based composer and artist Daniel Lentz, who's known for intricate musical processes often combined with the human voice. His works have been commissioned and performed by the Los Angeles Philharmonic, the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and noted ensembles and soloists around the world. With more than 20 recordings and 2 new releases on the way, he's never far away from his keyboard. Lentz was born in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, but began moving around the planet during his college years, finding inspiration in his travels. In 1968, Daniel Lentz was a visiting lecturer at UCSB in Santa Barbara for 2 years, but the peripatetic composer bounced in and out of California, spending time in Berlin, Arizona, Paris, Sweden, New Mexico, and most recently, Italy. He returned to Santa Barbara in 2008, where he continues to compose and record. I'm Leslie Westbrook for Issues and Ideas. Welcome to the program, Daniel. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a number of things, but musically a work which I call K's for now. I haven't gotten a good title yet. Dealing with what I think might have been available in the ancient caves, the prehistoric caves of places like Chauvet and Lascaux. And so I'm using instruments like strings because there were guts. Voices, of course, bone flutes, so forth and so on.
I wanted to ask you how the landscape has perhaps inspired some of your music. I know you lived in New Mexico in the land of enchantment. Paris is near and dear to you. You've done pieces involving wine glasses and food. So maybe tell us a little bit, and we'll go specifically to listen to a piece that was inspired by such travels.
I noticed this after the fact when I move. First time I noticed it, when I moved from Santa Barbara to Los Angeles. In about a year, my music probably tripled in speed living there. And then after 10 years in L.A., I moved to Arizona. And my music slowed down and got a little darker. And we'll hear some of that if we play a little of Apologetica, which was done in Arizona. And we'll hear a little of the Crackin' Bell, which is a piece I did with the L.A. Phil, and I don't know what else we'll be playing, but yeah, the place turns out to be very important.
Well, why don't we start with an excerpt from Apologetica. When I first met you about 15 years ago, that album had just come out, and it really knocked me off my feet.
The singers in this are American. It's a Los Angeles group. The strings are from the Czech Republic. They were recorded there. And yeah, so it's a mixture. It's recorded in 2 different places. I was always interested in the Spanish invasion of the Americas and put together a text, the lyrics from various sources. And one of the pieces on the CD is called Totoka, which is a combination of Hopi and Navajo, I put to make that word, which means rest in peace. But the title piece, Apologetica, that text is pretty directly from the Tears of the Indians, a book in the 16th century by Father Bartolome de las Casas. And he accompanied Cortez in the invasions, and it's very powerful writing.
A very moving piece of music, one of my favorites.
Thank you.
Why don't we talk about and listen to something from Songs of the Sirens, composed in 1973?
I was in Santa Barbara when I wrote this. And I've been always intrigued with electronics, not for the what they do with sound, but what they can do with time. And so Songs of the Sirens is just for basically just a cello who also speaks and a piano. And at the last minute or minute and a half, the last so-called cycle, a clarinet comes in and plays the melody that was formed by bits and pieces through this echo process I devised.
And how did that work, the echo process?
Well, you'll hear the cellist, that's the easiest part to tell what's happening. She plays a note in the cello and she enunciates the phoneme, like L or S. And that cycle was, I think, 45 seconds long. Then the next time she does it, you hear the first one she's doing. And then she adds more phonemes and more phonemes with each cycle. There are 10 altogether. And by the time the 10th cycle, you have this poem that I made up from Ulysses, the Odyssey, when he confronts the sirens. And I thought that was one of the earliest examples of somebody trying to deal with the power of music.
That was really lovely and so transportive. That was a selection from Songs of the Sirens by composer and Santa Barbara resident Daniel Lentz, who I'm talking with on Issues and Ideas.
That was a commission from the Los Angeles Philharmonic for their new music ensemble and my ensemble, the Daniel Lentz Group. And in the Cracking the Bells, the title piece of this CD, and I take an E.E. Cummings poem for this. And the Kraken bell, of course, refers to that bell in Philadelphia. And also, to me, the Kraken, the society at that time in the mid-80s when I made this piece.
Daniel Lentz has received numerous grants and awards, including several from the National Endowment for the Arts, a Fulbright in electronic music, and more recently a grant that included a month-long residency from the Rockefeller Foundation. He traveled to Bellagio, Italy, where he was put up in the Rockefeller Villa to compose. Lentz says he was very well looked after.
Very well looked after, yes. And I had a nice little studio overlooking Lake Como. I worked on a piece dealing with the war crimes of from an American perspective. It's like what I call secular oratorio, and it's for a string orchestra, which is the gallery and the courtroom, a 12-member choir, which is the jury, and a couple of soloists, the two attorneys and the judge. And the first part of the piece, the text is taken from the letters of the musical scale, literally. So if I want them to, if I want the word dead, they sing D-E-A-D. And when you sing that, that can be, each part can extend that letter to form chords, if you know what I mean. Like the D can be held because there's no end to it. So anyway, I created literally hundreds of words just with those notes. I took a little liberty like Bach did with the H, made it a B flat. But other than that, they're all the exact notes as they're called.
So I thought it'd be fun, since this is a radio interview, to go out with Talk Radio, which is another piece from that period when you were working in Los Angeles that really gives you that feeling of freeways and transportation and being stuck in a car.
Yeah, the text is taken from radio broadcasts. And there's the traffic, news, and weather. There are three sections of the piece, and that's what they are.
Thank you, Daniel, for sharing just a little bit of your vast musical array. It was nice visiting with you, and I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Composer Daniel Lentz lives in Santa Barbara. His latest recording is Celli on the Cold Blue Music label. The War Crimes Oratorio has not been recorded yet, but his next releases will be Café Desire and In the Sea of Ionia, both to be released in 2014, also on the Cold Blue Music label. Thank you to audio engineer Jeremy Gaylor. I'm Leslie Westbrook for Issues and Ideas.
And you're listening to Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio. Still ahead on today's program, we take a look at Cuesta College's music program, which is a breeding ground for fine musicians who go on to successful careers. Marisa Waddell talks with Cuesta's Director of Choral Studies, John Knutson, about the college's music program and some concerts that are coming up this season. Also, correspondent Tom Wilmer takes a trip to some museums in Independence, Missouri, including a hair museum. But first, Wilmer visits Little Rock, Arkansas, and shares the story of the Little Rock Nine, the nine African-American children who attempted to start classes at the all-white Central High School.
Well, I know the law will make a way.
September 4th, 1957. Summer vacation was over, and it was the first day of school in Little Rock, Arkansas. Nine black children attempted to start classes at the all-white Central High School, but their entry was blocked by hundreds of Arkansas National Guardsmen. They'd been sent out on direct orders issued by Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus to block the entry of the nine students who will forever live on in history as the Little Rock Nine.
Units of the National Guard have been and are now being mobilized with the mission to maintain or restore the peace and good order of this community.
President Eisenhower subsequently dispatched the 101st Airborne Division and placed the Arkansas National Guard under federal command.
Such an extreme situation has been created in Little Rock. This challenge must be met. The troops are there pursuant to law solely for the purpose of preventing interference with the orders of the court.
With bayonets fixed, more than 1,000 federal troops provided protection and escorted the nine black students into the school as hundreds of taunting, rock-throwing white men and women venomously protested.
What about you, sir? Do you think the college students will show up?
If I got anything to do with it, they won't show up. Well, I think it's a breaking point of the school integration. I just don't feel that they have a right to go to school.
The nine were reluctantly allowed to attend classes, but not without endless harassment and abuse. And they were not allowed to attend any extracurricular affairs, proms, programs, or sports.
This is Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas. Troops, which for nearly 3 weeks lined the sidewalk here in front of the high school under orders to keep the colored students out, have been replaced now. And their orders to comply with the law, which means let the Negro students in if they come in.
The events of September 1957 at Central High School was a seminal turning point in America's civil rights movement. And the lessons learned live on at Little Rock Central High School today. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as we visit with Phyllis Brown, the little sister of Minnie Jean Brown, who was one of the Little Rock Nine, as she recalls the pure terror her family and friends lived with 24 hours a day.
We were in a state of terror.
We'll join Robin White, superintendent at the Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site, as she shares her passionate insights into the history and lessons learned.
They never expected the community to respond in that manner, to project so much anger or hostility.
And then we'll join Rex Deloney. He's a teacher at Central High School today, and he'll share his insights into the legacy of the Little Rock Nine that lives on palpably in the classroom, in the hallways, and throughout the entire community of Little Rock, Arkansas, and across America.
That's the same place they had signs saying, get away. And now all it says is, welcome to Little Rock Central High School.
My name is Phyllis Brown.
Tell us about your relationship to Little Rock and your sister in a point in time in history. How old were you when the Little Rock Nine event happened?
I was nine.
Do you remember that time? Do you remember what was going on? What did you think?
I remember lots of stuff about it. I remember the terror. I remember how it had affected our household, our family, not only the Brown household, but how it affected the families of all of the nine, how they were all fractured and had to build itself back up, and how we were all sent away to live with relatives.
Your parents were fearful for your lives.
Yes, we were in a state of terror. You know, right now the world keeps using the word terrorist, but strangely they didn't use the word terrorist during 1957, but it was terrorism.
When you think of your sister, do you remember her strength? What comes to your mind at that point in time when you watch her going off to school?
I remember words. I remember pictures of her smiling in spite of the fact that she had been kicked or pushed down the stairs or hit. There are pictures of her smiling.
And isn't that just incredible to see that strength and that optimism and power in one individual?
It runs in our family.
I can tell.
Yeah. My father said to my mother in 1957, let that girl go to that school. Yeah, she can go to that school. And then to hear my mother say she had to do it, you know, that tells me who I came from.
Your sister, did she complete high school there, and then did she move away to college?
She was expelled from Central.
Oh, really?
Yes, and you will hear her say, even currently, how bad it made her feel that she was expelled. But her expulsion was to her response to being terrorized.
She was attacked by some white girls. Well, tell us what happened with that.
Yes, daily attacks throughout the day, all kinds of attacks. And one day she responded. She was expelled.
So what did she do then? How did she graduate from high school?
Oh, my gosh, she must have had some kind of guardian angel on her shoulder, because she was invited to New York City to live with the famous doctors Kenneth and Mamie Clark, and she graduated from New Lincoln High School.
Wow. And then she went on to college. Tell us what she did with her life and her career.
She did go to college. She went to Southern Illinois University, met her husband, and went to Canada, and she forged a life as a Canadian.
Phyllis Brown, what a pleasure and honor to visit with you.
Robin White, superintendent at the Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site. I know
the Lord. Hi, Robin. Welcome.
Thank you. And I'd also like to welcome you to Little Rock and to Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site.
Tell us about what is so extra special about this site in your heart.
I have to take you back. I would like for you to travel with me a little bit and take this journey back to nearly over 100 years ago to New Orleans, Louisiana, where there was a strategic plan to address the Constitution and to address this law, this separate but equal law as far as the rail cars in New Orleans, Louisiana. Homer Plessy, along with the Citizens Committee, come up with this plan. Homer Plessy was jailed for riding in the front car. Case was taken all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. He was jailed and went to court contesting this law, stating that it was unfair to separate people by their color or by their race. Of course, that was the birth of the separate but equal doctrine, as he lost that case in decision with John Ferguson. Well, then we go forward to another case that was tested in the court with the education system, Brown versus Board of Education.
And that was 54?
That was 1954, May 17th, the U.S. Supreme Court landmark decision, where it was stated it was unconstitutional to separate students by race in the education system. Well, this was in 1954, so 3 years later, that decision was tested in Little Rock, Arkansas, where 9 African-American students enrolled in Central High School. And these students, basically, just, you know, regular students that saw an opportunity to pursue an equal education, whereas, of course, you know, even though we say separate and equal, of course, the books would not be equal. The school, science department, things just were not equal, okay? Just leave it at that. And enrolling in Central High School would give them a better opportunity to pursue their education. And, of course, it was contested with Governor Faubus raising a ruckus. You know, you think about it. You think about our kids today going to school. You wake up getting ready to fresh clothes, your new clothes, your shiny shoes, and you take off for school, and you're greeted by a crowd, a hostile crowd that protesting your entrance to the school or to go to school with their children. So what is special about this site is that we could say Little Rock was a catalyst of the civil rights movement. But what is really special about this site is that you had students standing in their moral convictions, their moral beliefs, that they had the right to have an equal education.
And they knew they were risking their literal lives to stand up.
Yes, they did. I don't think they realized the depth of it in the beginning, because these were students that they played with in their communities, that they had a friendship with, you know, so they taught. And they never expected the community to respond in that manner, to project so much anger or hostility.
And pure hate.
Pure hate. Yeah. You're right. You're right. And so this site represents many things as far as a symbol of nonviolence, the pursuance of an equal education and equality, but also courage, taking the opportunity to pursue and stand in your birthright heritage.
We'll make a way. I know the Lord will make a way.
I remember as a little child, I was in Washington, D.C. I remember watching the news and seeing that, and it was just so shocking and stunning, almost paralyzing for a lot of people to see that reality. And when those kids first arrived and there was lines of National Guard, they were not there to protect them.
The National Guard actually were commissioned the governor to actually keep them out.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth Edward was one, that a student that you see with the crowd behind her screaming out and surrounded her, and each time she attempted to enter, they barred her entrance. And they did the same thing with Terrence Roberts as well. But it's so powerful that you have this child and in all her innocence and surrounded in this vicious mob screaming and hollering, and she is standing in her convictions and holding it all together and pursuing her dream, and at the same time and this attack, and you just want to do anything in your power to protect her. Also makes you reflect on just the beauty of this, the strength of this child, keeping it together, not running, not falling apart, but walking in grace and walking in glory. That's what I see.
Yeah.
And it gives me strength when I am faced with a challenge.
Powerful. I wish we could spend all afternoon with you. This has been so touching, so poignant. I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Robin White, the superintendent at the Little Rock Central High School National Historic Site.
Greg Stallone, head of the art department at Little Rock Central High School today.
You can't walk through those halls, can't be in those classrooms without telling kids and reminding them that, hey, this is where it started. This is where it started for the whole world, the United States. This is where everything started for you. This is equality. You're walking on that same ground. I said, you're in the same cafeteria. I said, when you go out in front of the school, that's the same place they had signs saying, get away. And now all it says is, welcome to Little Rock Central High School.
Awesome. Very touching.
Rex Deloney, fine arts instructor, fine arts department chairman, Little Rock Central High School.
I'm Tom Wilmer.
Said he wouldn't make a way. Said he wouldn't make a way. Said he wouldn't make a way. For you. For you. For you.
This is Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. You can find a link to Tom Wilmer's NPR podcast, including his full interview on the Little Rock Nine, on our Facebook page, facebook.com/KCBXFM. Still coming up on today's program, correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us on a trip to some museums in Independence, Missouri, including a hair museum. But first, we take a look at Cuesta College's music program as Marisa Waddell talks with the school's director of choral studies, John Knutson.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. Cuesta College in San Luis Obispo has long been known for its music department. Alumni have gone on to successful careers as full-time musicians and teachers. The music department has presented performers like Ray Charles, Buddy Rich, and many others. And in November, they'll hold their 15th annual Cuesta Vocal Jazz Festival, featuring the four freshmen as headliners. We'll learn more about that in a moment, but first I'd like to introduce you to my guest, John Knutson, who is in charge of the choral program at Cuesta. He's an active performer also with the Long Beach-based a cappella vocal jazz group Vocal. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Marisa.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You started out as a classical piano major, but you switched to vocal when you were studying, I understand.
That's right.
What made you switch?
I had carpal tunnel syndrome.
Oh, my.
Yes. It was kind of a forced switch.
And lucky for you, you could sing, huh?
Yeah. Well, and I'm really happy, yeah. I don't think I would have been on the Carnegie stage as a pianist. So it's really fun to be able to work with lots of groups of singers. And there aren't big piano ensembles.
Right.
So, no, I feel like it was the hand of fate was treating me well.
But you also are both strong in classical and jazz teaching and performing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that crossover and how that feels to you.
Sure. Well, it happened when I was in New York studying, trying to repair my hands at a special institute for performing artists in New York City. And in the sheet music store, there was an ad for a cappella doo-wop group that would perform at a Greenwich Cabaret Club. So I got into that group, and it was kind of jazzy. And then I wanted to seek that out further. I went to a convention for jazz educators, and then I met Phil Mattson and studied with him in Iowa. And that's where I sort of learned about jazz writing and singing and playing. It was a community college, actually. I went there after I had my bachelor's degree.
Uh-huh. And so, and that's what you do at Cuesta, is you teach both vocal jazz and vocal classical performance.
Yes, exactly what Phil Mattson did. He really is my mentor, you know.
That's great. Can you give me a little bit of background about the vocal program at Cuesta?
Sure. It was started there by Earl Blakesley, father of Sam Blakesley, our former state senator. Blakesley and all that. He went on to become a money manager after he left Cuesta.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of in its current form starting around about 1996 with Paul Hondorp, who actually started sort of a formal program, you know, with beginning groups and advanced groups and two vocal jazz ensembles as a beginning and an advanced. And so from 1996 till now, it sort of just continued on this trajectory.
So Cuesta has several ensembles of all different kinds, from the very large master chorale to some smaller ensembles. Can you tell me about the different ensembles?
Sure. I'll go from the, like you mentioned, there's sometimes 120 people in the master chorale, and then there's combos, which sometimes are just four jazz musicians, instrumentalists. In the middle, there's the jazz band and the wind ensemble. And then in the evening, there's the Monday Night Jazz Band, which features a lot of local professional players.
My dad's in that one.
Exactly, yeah. Gerald Voss and Ken Husad and that crew.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the choral program, and which I just mentioned. We have the two bigger choirs. We have two vocal jazz groups. There's the North County Chorus. And back to the master chorale.
So chock full of performance groups and performances throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the difference between the groups that are featuring more community members and older people as opposed to the groups that are full-time students.
Yeah, well, it just so works out that the ones during the day are almost all traditional students. And that's not true at all community colleges, but at Cuesta, it really does feel like generally, with some exceptions, it's mostly like 18 to 22-year-old. What you think of as they call a traditional college student. They rehearse a little more often, and they tend to memorize their music, and they may not be as experienced or just knowledgeable about music in general, but because we see them more often, they get a pretty high level of polished music, and they do a couple concerts a semester. The evening groups are a little less highly auditioned, and they have sometimes a wider range within each group. It's fun, you know. There'll be some really like professional singers and voice teachers in the evening groups, or professional players, as well as just some community members that come in there and kind of just learn by observing and playing along and stuff, you know. So it's a lot more diverse, I would say, the evening groups with the adults.
So let's talk a little bit more about the chamber singers.
Yeah, well, the Cuesta Chamber Singers is the big choir, the top auditioned choir. They were the first group founded back then in 1995 or 96 by Paul Hondorp. They have had some wonderful accolades in recent years. I've started taking them to Europe in 2005 and then returned in 2008. And at that point, made some connections in France and in Austria of people that just kind of want to host them and sell tickets for them and give us a little cut of the tickets and the CD sales. And so it almost makes it so we can tour there for free because we get some money from selling the tickets and the CDs, and they put up the concerts and feed us and house us and stuff like that. And the one in Austria is a competition. They got second place in the competitive category there. In Europe, they have a big tradition of competitive festivals, but they don't have a big tradition of formal music education ensembles. So ensembles in Europe are almost always community-based. So this is the first time they'd ever had a collegiate ensemble compete. And we got second place against, you know, some kind of professional choirs and that kind of thing. It was pretty cool.
And that's really impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty cool. And they also competed back in 2009 at the California International Choral Festival. And there were groups from Spain and Germany and Philippines. And they got second place in every category at that one, too. The Cuesta Chamber Singers did.
Wow. Yeah. So how many people in that ensemble usually?
Usually 30. It'd be 30, 35.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of repertoire do you focus on for the chamber singers?
I just try to focus on everything, like a broad range, since it's they're just community college students and they're younger, you know, first and second year students. I want them to experience everything from medieval music. through Renaissance music, madrigals and motets and Bach and Mozart and some, even some opera choruses as well, some gospel, spirituals, the whole realm.
Okay. It's Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest is John Knutson, who leads the vocal program in the Cuesta College Music Department.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Foce, the jazz group. That's your premier vet.
Right. Because it's a smaller group, it can really trim it down to like the top 8 or 10 singers in the whole program. Mm-hmm. And because they're a small group, I can travel with them really easily. We can just hop in a van and run out to the Lions Club meeting or the Retired Teachers Association, or we just did the Rotary Sunday morning. So they're probably the best known group around, I think. Because they sing on mics and because they do vocal percussion and they imitate instruments and all this stuff, I think they're kind of the most surprising group for people to hear. You know, people know what choirs sound like, but not everybody really knows what jazz vocal music sounds like. So they are the hosts of the Vocal Jazz Festival that we've done for 15 years now. And they're always warm up for the headliners on Friday and Saturday nights for that thing. So they get huge exposure there and really help recruit for our program.
And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. That Vocal Jazz Festival is coming up on November 1st and 2nd at the Cuesta Performing Arts Center.
Mm-hmm.
Are there instrumentalists that perform with the Voce group?
Yes. Most years, when I travel to Europe with them, we just go a cappella, so we can travel really light, because all you have to have is a microphone in your suitcase, and a sound guy shows up there, and you're singing. So most years, though, like this year, for instance, we are using drums and bass and piano and guitar, and then I think there's 11 singers in the group this year. It's a little bigger group, and they'll be warming up for the four freshmen, which is kind of cool because one of the four freshmen I went to college with in Iowa, and the other four freshmen, one of the two, he was a Cuesta student back around late 90s.
Give me some background about the Vocal Jazz Fest, and then tell me about this upcoming festival.
Mm-hmm. It was founded in 1998 by Graham Longauger. He was my predecessor, who now teaches at University of British Columbia. And it started small. It was a one-day thing called the Vocal Jazz Workshop, maybe 7 or 8 schools. It's always been sort of a recruiting event where students will come from high schools and colleges. They perform for 20, 25 minutes, and then they'll go off stage, and a clinician, like an outstanding educator or professional musician, will work with them for 25 minutes. And the director gets newly inspired and new ideas, and the students hear new ideas. And most importantly, a lot of times the students hear the same ideas that the teacher had been working on with them. Mm-hmm. Only when they hear it from the esteemed maestro, professional clinician, then they finally do it. So teachers love it. I take my students to festivals in San Diego or, Grass Valley or wherever. There's a great vocal jazz festival going on, too. And at the same time, they get to then see our amazing campus, our wonderful new performing arts center. This year, there'll be about 400 students, about 28 different ensembles. And then they get to hear Voce. They all come to the evening concerts. They get to hear the four freshmen, because there's nothing quite like hearing a professional group that's on the road, just how polished they are.
So the festival itself really is for these high school and college students.
Mm-hmm.
And then the community gets to benefit because there's a concert
right.
both nights.
Yes.
So
Friday
and Saturday night, the 1st and 2nd of November, 8 o'clock both nights?
8 o'clock both nights. It tends to kind of sell out because it fills up with at least each night fills up with a couple hundred high school or college students. So the community members would be best off getting their tickets in advance if they want to go.
Okay.
And that would be either at cpactickets.cuesta.edu or 546-3198.
Okay, and they can find more about the festival at vocaljazzfestival.com?
Yeah, right? That's easy to remember.
Okay. Uh-huh. So you say that one of the four freshmen is a Cuesta alum, and tell me about the group in general. They've been around a long time, haven't they?
They have, yeah. They've been around since the late 40s, and they really hit their stride around the mid-50s. With some songs on the charts back when jazz was still kind of the pop music.
A country dance was being held in the garden. I felt a bump and heard an oh, beg your pardon.
So their kind of heyday was from like the mid-50s to the mid-60s until the British invasion and all that, and rock and roll kind of took over the radio. So anybody who was really listening to pop music in the 50s and early 60s probably has heard of the Four Freshmen and heard their songs. They kept at it, though. Unlike almost any other group, they've never stopped. People will retire here and then they'll add somebody new, but they always hew to the almost exact same writing tradition. They mm-hmm. still write arrangements, mm-hmm. and they still sound just like the 50s ones. They still sing with the same tone.
And they were also really well known for being multi-instrumentalists, too. Is that still true?
Yeah, that's a really unique thing about them, is that it's just four guys. They all play an instrument. The drummer plays, the guitar player plays, the trumpet player sings. I mean, they all play and sing while they perform. So I think that makes them really a financially viable group, because mm-hmm. it's just four people to split the money. You don't have to pay a bass player and you don't have to pay a drummer.
Mm-hmm. So that's Four Freshmen coming up, the headliners of the 15th annual Cuesta Vocal Jazz Festival. That's Friday and Saturday, November 1st and 2nd at the Cuesta Performing Arts Center. 8 o'clock shows, and you can get more details at vocaljazzfestival.com. What's still to come this season for Cuesta Music?
The December craziness, the holiday concerts, and all the little gigs we do, because every little party and organization wants some Christmas carolers or just some kind of, you know, winter holiday festive stuff going on. So it gets pretty busy.
How about contact information about the Cuesta College Music Department?
Well, the main line there is 546-3195. That's 546-3195 if people want to talk and get transferred to the appropriate person. Our website is cuesta.edu/performing arts.
Great. Well, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Marisa. Appreciate it.
John Knutson, in charge of the choral program at Cuesta College Music Department. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.
Come on, girl, listen to me. You're so wonderful and sweet, but you've never even looked at me. Mm-hmm. But I know deep in my heart that I am the one that you dreamed of. But take a chance with me. I wanna be with you. I just know you want me.
This is Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Support for KCBX is provided in part by Festival Mosaic's Winter Mezzo Chamber Music Weekend, with Scott Yu on violin, Bjorn Sang cello, and John Novacek on piano, performing trios by Haydn, Beethoven, and Dvorak, November 1st through the 3rd. Details and tickets are available at festivalmosaic.com. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being. David Sloan Wilson believes that evolution is not just a description of how we got here. He says it can also be a toolkit for improving how we live together. He tells us how his goal is to help people behave pro-socially, that is, at their best and for the good of the whole. Coming up next on today's Issues and Ideas, correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us on a trip to some museums in Independence, Missouri, including a hair museum. This is KCBX.
I want to be with you. I just know you want me.
I'm Tom Wilmer. I journeyed to Independence, Missouri to visit the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library. But while in town, somebody told me about the only hair museum in the United States, and I just couldn't resist a visit to Leala Cahoon's Hair Museum. Cosmopologist Leala Cahoon started collecting hair and hair art back in 1956. Not just hair, but hair art, hair wreaths, hair rings, bracelets, and much more. Leal explained that hair art served as a primary visual source for family genealogy before the advent of photography. Come along and join me for a visit with Leala Cahoon in her hair museum in Independence, Missouri.
Give me a head with hair, long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming.
You're at Leala's Hair Museum, the only one in the whole world.
Tell us about hair and how it became art.
I have traced this art form to the 15th century. A lady in Norway traced it to the 12th century, so it's a real old art form.
Tell us, in what ways did they turn hair into art?
It's genealogy done with human hair. Before the camera was invented, they used the hair and made the flowers and put the person's name beside it. And that one that I'm looking at has 86 different names on it.
A family tree in hair.
A family tree in hair.
When does this date from and to?
1880-something, I believe.
All of these flowers and all these decorations are all made out of hair.
Yes, and they put the person's name, and then there's a number by the side of the hair, so it tells who donates the hair.
Hair does not really decay or degrade. It stays...
No, sir. I have a picture of a little girl they found in Peru recently, and she was 4,000 years old. She still had her hair, her hairstyle. The hair color was still there, and her eyelashes.
Wow, that's amazing.
Hair is the only part of the body that doesn't disintegrate. Mm-hmm. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Do you want to take us around through your museum?
I'd love to.
Okay. How did all these women 150 years ago learn the art?
It was passed down from one generation to the other. They didn't write books about it. And it has taken me 32 years to figure out how they made these hair wreaths. It was nothing that they wrote down. They just did it. A knitting needle, a darning needle, or a plain old sewing needle. Then counted the hairs. I remember as a kid when I was growing up, my grandmother used to watch someone and she'd say, "Oh, she doesn't have the nerve to count hairs." And I didn't know what grandma meant, and now I do. Mm-hmm. And so it's time consuming. You're counting hairs. If you're going to make a daisy with 9 petals, then you would count out how many hairs that you're going to use for one petal. And since nature is uneven, 9 or 11, then you'd count out that many more piles of hair with the same number of hairs. Not only is it tedious work, but it is time consuming.
And women save their hair, right? There was even a place to put your hair on your dressing table.
Yes, and I have some of those out here in this other case I'll show you. The hair receivers is what they are called. When you're working with hair, you can't work with it upside down. And so it has scales on it. It would make a very fuzzy-looking hairpiece if you used it upside down.
A lot of details, a lot of technical things involved in hair art.
Yes.
Is there like an armature or something that you tie the hair to, or is it all the hair self-supporting?
You have a knitting needle, you have to have a piece of wire, and a piece of hair.
So the wire, it would be the black or the dark form that gives it structure. When was the heyday of the Renaissance of hair as art?
During Queen Victoria's time, when it was the most popular. And she had a bracelet that was made from her husband's hair when he passed away. But when I got to Scotland, I found a whole different story about Queen Victoria and young John Brown, who was the guy that she liked.
Yeah.
Yes. And so when she was buried, I have a story where she was buried with both her husband's hair and his hair.
Interesting.
These are made of horsehair. When you see white hair in one of these, then it's horsehair. The brooches, the ones that have black and say in memory of, or if they have pearls, that means as in death. The rest of it was given as in friendship. This one is the Thomas family, and I have from the 1500s, I have each of the men's name. In 1800, they came to America.
How and when exactly did you decide to do this?
Well, I started dressing hair in 1949. I had my own beauty salon by 1956. I went down to the Country Club Plaza and went by an antique store that had this little square frame. I didn't buy shoes that year. I bought the hair arrangement. When you look at this little square frame out here, it says the most expensive piece in the entire place because look what it started. And that was my husband's words.
Very good. This is the only hair museum in basically the world?
The whole world, yes. There's a man in Germany that has a collection, 400 pieces. And I flew over to see his collection. But it's in a private collection. It's not in a museum.
Do you have George Washington's hair there? Is that what that is?
Yes, and his signature. Daniel Webster. This is his brooch when he passed away. If you look at the back, it has his death date on it and a whole bunch of his hair in it. Ronald Reagan, this is his manicurist. She's a friend of mine. It's Michael Jackson's hair, the day that he made the Pepsi commercial, burned his hair. John Lennon, Marilyn Monroe, John Kennedy. He was at Peter Lawford's house the day that that piece of hair was cut. Abraham Lincoln and Alexander Hamilton. By 1930, they started postcards that went through the mail.
So they're basically postcards with little wigs on them.
Yes. You would have your picture taken, put your own hair on there, and then mail it. See, they all have a stamp on the back and an address.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been absolutely wonderful. What a pleasure to come your museum.
Thank you. I enjoy showing it to everyone. Never get tired of talking about it. Never get tired of collecting more. My name is Leila Cahoon. I'm in Independence, Missouri. I'm on the internet. You can find Leila's Hair Museum. You can email me, lcahoon@aol.com, and I'll answer as soon as I get around to it.
Well, thank you so much.
All day it was hair, long hair, shining.
Come along and join me now at the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library in Independence, Missouri, followed by a look at the National Frontier Trails Museum.
Right now, we're with Donna Denslow, Marketing and Sales Manager at the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library in Independence, Missouri. Hi, Donna.
Welcome to the Truman Museum and Library. It was actually the first library that was created from the 1955 Presidential Libraries Act.
A little aside, what does S stand for in Harry S. Truman?
We probably get that question every single day.
Mm-hmm.
The S doesn't really stand for any one name. I mean, most people's middle name, it does stand for something. But the S in Truman's middle name was a compromise. It stood for both of his grandfathers, actually. Solomon Young and Anderson Ship Truman were his two grandfathers.
The other interesting thing that I just learned is that he was one of the only ex-presidents who used his library as his real office and conducted his paperwork and archival stuff himself here.
He built what we refer to as his working office in the Truman Library and Museum, and he came to that office and worked every day. I mean, he walked the distance here from the Truman home. When his health no longer would allow the walk, they drove him. So he was here every day, very, very involved in the library, and was well known to come out and talk to school children about the role of being president. People still have great memories today who actually visited the museum and actually had a chance to experience seeing him.
Another little Truman aside that I find very touching is once he retired and Bess and Harry lived in their little home down the street, he would just go for walks around town by himself, sons, Secret Service.
You know, he was just an average man. He came from humble beginnings, and, you know, being in Washington never changed him. When he came back to Independence, it was like he never left. He just kind of picked up and was still Mr. Truman.
Tell us about some of your favorite Truman quotes.
Probably the most famous one is, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. And then the buck stops here. It's a phrase, too, and a lot of political individuals today use that phrase, as did Truman. Probably the one that I've used most recently is, if I can get it straight, every reader doesn't have to be a leader, but every leader should be a reader. And if you know your history, Truman read an awful lot of books.
And let's add another little Truman aside, and that is that he never went to college, a self-taught man based on his personal reading.
That's right, his readings and in his life experiences. I mean, he worked on the farm, he was in the military, he was self-taught.
Tell us about some of the elements of the Truman Library that you're most proud of. What would be the things that you would make sure that we saw?
The one that comes to mind is our replica of his Oval Office. And the reason I say that is because about 10 years before he passed away, he recorded a message about his Oval Office. And so when visitors step inside, Truman starts talking to them and telling them about the contents of the Oval Office. And I just think that's wonderful. You know, so he's been gone for a long time, and I think that's wonderful for people today to be able to step in there and hear his voice.
Give us a mental walking tour through the facility.
Our permanent exhibits, in addition to the replica of his Oval Office, we have an exhibit on his presidential years. It covers everything that took place during the years that he was in office, the decisions that he made. We also have an exhibit on his life and times that covers everything but his presidential years. So everything that took place before he went to D.C., including his military career, his marriage to Bess Truman, the birth of their daughter. That exhibit picks up when he came back to Independence and the travels that they made and building the Truman Library and Museum. And then visitors can have a view of Truman's working office. As I mentioned, that's where he came and worked every day, and they can see the inside of this office.
What are you you most proud of Harry Truman? What touches your heart the most?
When I think about politicians today, I think he was and still is the most down-to-earth individual that we could ever have had in the White House.
They definitely don't make Harry S. Trumans anymore.
They don't make Trumans anymore.
Like Nixon had his Western White House, Truman had his little White House. So tell us about that, which is not here.
No, it is not here. Truman didn't have Camp David either, as most of the presidents do today. He had his little White House, and this was in Key West, Florida. It is still there today. Probably the one thing that I think most people would be okay with is where he did a lot of poker playing. We've got a lot of pictures in our archives about activities that he did.
All right, Donna Denslow, it's been a pleasure to have you share with us.
Tom, thank you very much. I'm so glad you've been with us today, and hope your listeners might do the same and pay us a visit.
I would highly recommend it. We've been speaking with Donna Denslow at the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library in Independence, Missouri. We're here with Jill Schumacher. Tell us where we are. This is a wonderful location.
We're at the National Frontier Trails Museum. We tell a story of the Oregon, California, and Santa Fe trails and the Mormon Trail here. We officially do all those trails, and no other museum in the United States officially has that option.
This was the starting point, wasn't it?
It was the jumping off place back from the 1820s through the 1850s. More people came here because of the fresh spring water. We had all the blacksmith shops, everything you would need to make the trail west. And we're actually sitting on top of some ruts underneath this building that went west.
Jill, tell us about some of the highlights and what the kids love most about this place.
They love the story of Sacagawea. They love the story of the mules and the oxen. And when they find out that an ox falls over when you try to change your shoes, they are absolutely enamored of the idea.
Jill Schumacher, thank you so much for sharing with us.
You're welcome very much. Come visit us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
For further information about exploring Independence, Missouri, log on to visitindependence.com. For further information about the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library, log on to trumanlibrary.org. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Independence, Missouri.
And that does it for today's Issues and Ideas here on KCBX. I've been your host, Brian Lanzone. You can find a link to Tom Wilmer's NPR podcast, as well as a picture of some of the hair art described in this last interview, at our Facebook page, facebook.com/KCBXFM. Support for Issues and Ideas comes from the Basin Street Regulars, presenting America's music on the Central Coast and reminding you that their Jubilee by the Sea is October 24th through the 27th. More information is online at pismojazz.com. This is KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. We are streaming live on the web at kcbx.org. Stay tuned next for On Being with Krista Tippett. Then at 3 o'clock, it's Fresh Air. On today's program, music critic Milo Miles tells us about electro swing. It's a popular dance club style from Europe. At 4 o'clock, it's American Public Media's Marketplace, followed by All Things Considered at 4:30. At 6:30, the music begins tonight with KCBX in concert, followed by Classical Showcase at 8 o'clock, and The Cutting Edge with Ron Emenheiser is at 10 o'clock. That's all coming up here on Public Radio KCBX, serving South Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties.